All right, so everyone good up to this point on the slides? Let's go to slide 5 then and look at PCR in more detail. Like I said, PCR mimics cellular DNA replication, but it does it slightly differently. It accomplishes the same thing. It occurs in cycles, and each cycle, exactly the same thing is done as in the previous cycle. And so you program the thermal cycler to perform as many cycles as you want. Like I said, typically it's about 40. But each individual cycle has 3 steps within it. And those steps are called denaturation, elongation, denaturation first, second is annealing, and then elongation. So these are the steps of PCR for one cycle. Denaturation, annealing, and elongation. Now, what does it mean to denature? We've used this word before. Well, here nature means the quality of something. But specifically, what does it mean when you denature a molecule? Right, but the quality we're talking about is the shape. So I think I mentioned it when we talked about proteins. Proteins can be denatured either by changing the temperature or changing the pH. To denature a protein means to drastically change its shape. And that's bad for a protein because proteins have their functions based on their shape. They have to be the right shape in order to perform their correct function. But you can use the same word applied to nucleic acids, like DNA. In this case, denaturing the DNA means splitting it into 2 strands. In other words, breaking those hydrogen bonds that hold the 2 strands together. Well, remember I said that PCR is mimicking what's happening in the cell, and what happens in the cell first is really denaturation. We call it initiation, right? But really what is happening in that initiation step inside a cell is a separation of the 2 strands of the DNA from each other, a breaking of the hydrogen bonds. Now, how did we say that cells accomplish that? By what? Right, using an enzyme, which is named helicase, but it does it enzymatically. The strands are separated via an enzyme. Well, PCR needs to mimic the process, so it needs to separate the strands as well, but it doesn't use an enzyme to do it. Instead, PCR uses temperature, high temperature. It uses heat to do the job. Now, if you think back to how DNA is made, how it's built, I mean, what it's built of, the 2 strands are held together by hydrogen bonds, right? Whereas an individual strand is a bunch of nucleotides that are held together by different kinds of bonds. What are those called? Does anyone remember? Right. Phosphodiester bonds hold nucleotides together along the length of one strand. And what do you know about phosphodiester bonds compared to hydrogen bonds?
Stronger.
Much stronger. Phosphodiester bonds are covalent bonds. They're very strong. So they do not get disrupted if you just heat this thing up to a certain temperature. That certain temperature being around 96 degrees centigrade, which is almost boiling temperature. Pretty hot, right? But not hot enough to break apart those very strong phosphodiester bonds. That's plenty hot, though, to make those very weak hydrogen bonds between the two strands come apart. So that's why high temperature is used in PCR each cycle. Each cycle it goes up to about 96 degrees centigrade so that the two strands in each piece of DNA separate from each other. That's denaturation. It does the same exact thing that the enzyme does in the cell, right? So it doesn't matter that we're doing it differently. We're still mimicking the effect. You have to get the two strands apart from each other so that each strand then can be separately read as a code for how to build a new strand that's just like the one you removed. Okay? And that's shown in step one up here. In this idealized example, we're starting with just a single piece of DNA. Normally you would have many in your sample, but this is just showing you, even if you start with just one piece of DNA, well, it is a two-stranded molecule. So denaturation just refers to the step in which the two strands are separated from each other. An enzyme does not do that in the thermal cycler. Instead, heat does that, which is why we have to heat it up to 96. Okay, that happens every cycle. So every time a new cycle starts, it has to heat back up to 96 degrees. The second step within each cycle is annealing. And annealing refers to coming together of complementary pieces of DNA. But it's not... You don't want the two strands that you just separated from coming together, even though they can. And that's one thing that disallows you from actually getting the true maximum number of DNA in the end. That's one thing that can go wrong, basically, is that the two strands you just separated can go right back together. But what you want to anneal, the two pieces that you want to come together, are the one of the two exposed strands from the DNA that you just split into two, and a primer that already has to be in your mix. So when you set up a PCR reaction, yes, the machine does almost all the work. You set it and forget it. Come back the next day or hours later and you have billions of copies of DNA that made for you. But only if you set up the machine properly. And I don't mean just program it. I mean you have to have in your little tubes that you put in the machine, you have to have not only your sample DNA that you're trying to amplify, you also have to have other ingredients that are required for amplifying that DNA. All right? Now, of course, some of the ingredients are going to be nucleoside triphosphates of all four kinds, right? The same thing that the cell naturally uses, nucleoside triphosphates. So you need the A type, the C type, the G type, and the T type. And you need trillions and trillions of each of those in your mix already, because if you run out of them, you no longer make new DNA. So that's simply the raw materials, right, for making the new DNA, the nucleoside triphosphates. Those have to be in the mix. But also, you have to have in your mix primers. And primers are already pre-designed for the type of DNA you're working with. Primers look for a certain sequence, short sequence, that you know already is in that DNA you have. Even though you don't know everything about that DNA, if you know it came from a human, for instance, then you know because all humans have a certain sequence that that sequence is going to be in there. Okay? So you have to know a little bit about what you're working with to start this reaction. And actually, there are two different primers, billions of copies of each, but two different types of primers that we use in each trial. Those two primers are just like the RNA primers that a cell puts down first, right? The red piece that was in that cartoon, except these are made of DNA. We make them out of DNA ahead of time so that they don't have to be replaced. You don't have to replace RNA with DNA, which would be a complicated step that you'd have to mimic doing what the cell does. So we work with DNA and we already have those DNA primers pre-built by the millions in the mix before we put it into the thermal cycler. And the reason there are two different types of primers is that one primer looks for one end of the sequence you're interested in replicating. If this is the entire piece of DNA from the sample, remember I said that you're not going to make copies of the entire molecule. You're going to make copies of usually about a 10,000 base pair length fragment of it. So if we say that this is the fragment that you're interested in making copies of out of the whole thing, then one of your two types of DNA primers is going to look for this sequence on one strand, which is at one end of that fragment. And the other DNA primer is going to look for this sequence on the other strand at the other end of the fragment. Okay? So the placement of those two primers, when they find their match on the DNA in your sample, that's going to define the size of the fragment of DNA that's going to be repeated billions of times. And you see that happening right here. These red pieces are DNA primers. Those absolutely have to be in the mix, and they have to actually be complementary to something that is in the DNA, because if the primer doesn't find that complementary sequence in your sample, nothing's going to happen, right? The only thing that's going to find each other are the two strands that you just separated. So it's not going to multiply any DNA. That's why you can't go into it totally blindly. You have to know what kind of DNA you're working with. All right, now, the third step of each cycle, the final step of each cycle, is elongation. Annealing refers to just the primer coming together with the DNA. So the formation of hydrogen bonds between complementary pieces, that's annealing. Once you have that DNA primer laid down, then you can mimic exactly what the cell does during its elongation phase, right? Which is to add one nucleotide at a time to the growing chain. Right? That's exactly what happens here as well. And just like in a cell, we can't do this for free. We have to have an energy source. So we don't use nucleoside monophosphates. We use nucleoside triphosphates. Right? And each time one comes in, two of those phosphates are cleaved off. That provides the energy for making another link in the chain. Now, what did we say is responsible for making this happen in a cell, the elongation phase? Nucleoside triphosphates are the raw materials. But what makes it happen? What helps out?
Primase?
No, primase lays a primer down in the cell, and that's not used in PCR. Because we've already pre-made our DNA primers and put it in the mix. So primase isn't necessary. There's no RNA involved. What is it that helps out in adding one more nucleotide to the growing chain? Well, what are you doing when you're adding more and more nucleotides? You're forming what? A polymer. It is a polynucleotide, but that's the more general name is a polymer, right? So what's the enzyme?
Polymerase,
exactly. DNA polymerase is what a cell uses to be able to join that next nucleotide to the string of nucleotides that have already been put down. Now, you might be thinking, and it would be reasonable to think that the best polymerase to use, the best enzyme to do this, would be the enzyme that naturally does it. So, for instance, if we're trying to amplify human DNA from a crime scene, let's say, you might think, well, the best polymerase to use to do the job would be exactly the enzyme that makes human DNA. In other words, human DNA polymerase. Right? We can't do that, though. We can't use human DNA polymerase in PCR. Any idea why? Well, what is it about these conditions in PCR that would make that impossible? The temperatures, exactly. Each cycle, not in the elongation phase, but in each cycle, that same tube, which has to include the polymerase, is raised to 96 degrees centigrade, almost boiling point of water. That's not body temperature. Body temperature is in the 90s for Fahrenheit. This is centigrade. Normal human body temperature is 35 degrees centigrade. So 96 would kill human cells, right? Be like boiling us in water. It would kill the cells. Well, PCR doesn't use any cells, right? It's just a test tube, basically. But what does it do to the polymerase, which is an enzyme, right? What kind of molecules are enzymes? Proteins. And what will high heat do to a protein? Well, proteins aren't alive. It won't necessarily break the bonds. Probably won't. What do we call changing its shape? Denature it, yes. High temperature denatures proteins. It changes the shape of those proteins so they cannot do their job. So if you get human DNA polymerase up to 96 degrees centigrade, you're going to permanently change its shape, and it can no longer act as a catalyst. It can no longer help adding new DNA nucleotides to the growing chain. It just won't work. By the way, this denaturation is exactly what happens when we cook meat, or cook any food, really. But meat has a hell of a lot of protein in it, right? It's mostly protein. Well, when we cook meat, it doesn't just get hot. It tastes better to most people. It changes its texture, right? That's because all those proteins that are in the meat are now a different shape. And they're permanently a different shape, because you can cook meat, and even if you decide you want to eat that tomorrow instead, you can't just bring it back down to room temperature and have it turn into raw meat again. Right? In other words, the proteins don't go back into their normal shape after you've denatured them. They stay in that wrong shape. So if the protein that you are interested in having work is DNA polymerase, and you heat it up too far, you're going to ruin it. So we can't use normal DNA polymerase. And this was a sticking point in making PCR work, because a cell gets around this problem by not having to heat itself up in order to break the strands apart, right? Instead, it uses an enzyme to do that. PCR doesn't use an enzyme, it uses heat. So the key to making PCR work is that they had to find a special DNA polymerase that could withstand the high temperatures in the denaturation phase of each cycle. So where did they look? Where would you look if you had to find an enzyme that could survive that high temperature? Well, enzymes are in organisms. So you look for, all organisms use DNA polymerase because all organisms have to replicate their DNA. So you look where? Well, there aren't any animals that can withstand that heat. If there were such a thing, you'd be right. But no animal, certain bacteria. You boil water, you kill most bacteria, right? The bacteria that are around us and in us and on us all day. But there are some bacteria who not only survive boiling water, but thrive in it. That's their preferred temperature. They are called thermophilic bacteria, which literally means loving heat. Philia is love. Thermo refers to heat. So the people that invented this PCR process found a special bacterium called Thermophilus. Aquaticus, that's the genus and species name, and they isolated the DNA polymerase that these bacteria use for their own DNA replication, and that's the DNA polymerase that's used in PCR. And that's why it's called what's nicknamed TAC polymerase, T-A-Q. TAC polymerase simply refers to polymerase that has been isolated from Thermophilus aquaticus. The T of TAC is for Thermophilus, the A-Q is from the species, aquaticus. Okay? Even though it's not in PCR, even though it's not elongation that occurs at 96, elongation occurs at a lower temperature, 72. So that's when TAC polymerase is doing its job at the lower temperature. But still, it has to not be ruined when it's heated up in between each cycle. Okay? Wouldn't work without that. So that was a big breakthrough. All right, now on this same slide, we've gone through one cycle. And we're at elongation, the final phase. And elongation happens because you've already put the primer down and you already have in your mix all the raw materials you need, right? You have the enzyme to do the job, TAC polymerase, and you have the subunits in the form of nucleoside triphosphates to add one at a time. So the exposed strand is just going to be red in order to determine what new nucleotides to add. And elongation will occur for as long as you let it happen, or until you get to the very end of the DNA molecule, right? But the thing I just erased, this is the overall DNA molecule. For this strand, it started right here, and it's going to go this way, right? It'll go for until you stop it or until it hits the end. This one started here on the other strand. It's going to go this direction. It's going to go until you stop it or until it hits the end. Well, it doesn't get to the end because the thermal cycler is programmed to stay in the elongation phase only for a certain amount of time. It stays at that temperature only for what you program it to be. Then the next cycle starts. And when the next cycle starts, you go from 72 back up to 96 again. That's too high a temperature to keep these two strands that are forming next to each other. It tears them apart. So you see that happening right here. This is the next cycle of denaturation. So they've only gotten as long as they could up to the time when the next cycle starts. But they have gone past the other end of the fragment you're interested in, notice. Because the fragment length you're interested in is this. This one's already gotten longer than that, simply because you gave it more time. All right? But then the other two steps occur, and you make more DNA. Now you've doubled the amount of pieces that you have, but they're not yet at the correct length. Then you come to a third level, and this one that was a little too long now serves as a template for making this one. So the primer attaches here, and the other primer is already at the proper end. So you give it, each, in this cycle, you have more than enough time to get to this end, and then it stops, of course. So that means by the third cycle and on, you're making mostly pieces that are exactly the correct length. Every cycle, you make a couple that are a little bit longer than you want. And you don't want that, but you only make one of those each cycle, whereas you make many, many, and each cycle, the number of ones that you make the correct length gets bigger and bigger. So that after four cycles, yes, you have 40 of these pieces you don't want, but 40 out of 100 billion is practically nothing. Almost all the DNA you have is exactly the length that you want. You see why? You see why it takes three cycles to get to the point where you're making them just the right length? Because you make one that's too long, and then it serves as a template for one that finally gets to the right length. Okay, so that's the idea. And as long as you have enough stuff in your mix originally for this to happen for all of the cycles that you program, 40 or so, in other words, as long as you don't run out of A's, T's, C's, or G's, then you'll make exact DNA copies. And the reason that they are exact copies is for exactly the same reason that when a cell replicates its DNA, it's an exact copy. Because there is strict complementarity laws that have to be followed. A is always with T, C is always with G, so you end up making exact copies. All right, slide 6. This is an electrophoresis gel, so the PCR has already been done. Right? PCR by itself only provides you the DNA for whatever you need it for. Like I said, you might need it for several different kinds of tests. Well, one kind of test that you can do with DNA is to subject it to electrophoresis. So, and we've done electrophoresis in here. But the reason that electrophoresis works, the reason that you have a nice visible band, well, you guys didn't really, but the reason that a well-made electrophoresis gel has nice visible band is because there's enough DNA. A band, when you see a band in an electrophoresis gel, like these bands right here, a band is not one piece of DNA. One piece of DNA would be completely invisible. Just like one molecule of just about anything is invisible to the eye, to the human eye, right? Instead, you have millions of pieces of DNA in each individual band. But because they are exact copies of each other, they therefore have exactly the same size and shape. Right? And therefore, they move through the gel at exactly the same speed as each other. So, they started out in the well, they all move together, and therefore, since there's millions of them there instead of just one, you actually see the band. Well, that's an example of requiring enough DNA to do the job. If you started out with just a little bit of DNA and tried to electrophorese it, you wouldn't see anything. So instead, you take that tiny sample of DNA and you subject it to polymerase chain reaction to make billions of copies. Now you have plenty to put into a gel so that it will actually be visible as bands in the gel. And this specific example is just showing you that you have father's DNA here, the mother's DNA here. They're different, of course. And therefore, when they are cut apart by restriction enzymes, just like you used in the in your fingerprinting exercise, they produce bands of different size, and therefore they have different banding patterns. The child of these two is different from both. Well, of course, right? When two parents have a child, they mix their DNA. You don't make either the mother or either the father again. You make something that is a combination of both the mother's and the father's DNA. Therefore, all individuals are unique. They each have a different DNA fingerprint. But there are going to be some places where they match up because we don't completely scramble the DNA, right? We take on a gene-by-gene basis. We either get the maternal allele or the paternal allele. So certain fragments are certainly going to be identical, but not the entire thing. Is that the last slide? Yeah, that means it's the end of today. So you guys can go to bed.